Our final speaker is Mark Strand.
All right, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming. I feel like Praveen's talk last night, Jennifer's talk on beta cells, and Perry's talk on disgruntled normal cells gone rogue is like the other side of a bookshelf. That's like one bookend. And what I'm going to talk about is sort of the other side, which is the population level, on a related concept of diversity and unity. So in this presentation, I'm going to make the case, three basic arguments. First is that the trend toward excessive individualism is increasing in many aspects of society, that the principle of collectivism is necessary for sustainability of ecosystems defined by both biology, sociology, and theology, and that healthy individuals in sick populations are a result of an excessively individualistic approach to our shared life together as human beings. Individualism is a social and political philosophy that emphasizes individual freedom where the individual is of supreme importance. We saw this in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, his concept of the invisible hand, pursue your own self-interest to grow your economy. Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America identified individualism as like what it means to be American. No offense to our Canadians, American, North American, let's say. Biblical teaching that each individual is created in God's image focuses on the fact that we're created by God in our mother's womb as with individual value and volition. And it holds that the interests of normal adults are best served by allowing him or her maximum freedom and responsibility for choosing their objectives and their means for obtaining it. What's not to like about all of that? Individualism's been a part of human rights and civil rights movements. It empowers individuals to go against the grain of tyranny and harmful things. It's resulted in tremendous innovation in all levels of society, and many societies are moving from a more collective to a more individualistic approach. So what's not to like about this? Well, my question would be, is individualism a hard and fast rule of human existence, and how is individualism applied and understood in biology, sociology, and theology? So first, collectivism and sustainable ecosystems. So the biological argument. I thought Praveen's talk last night about our wonderful dance with bacteria and virus as a collaboration for human health and flourishing was fascinating, and it's part of what I'm implying here. So we have cells which come together to form tissues, which have to work together to make organs, which have to work together to make a functioning organism or individual, which then comes together as groups to form a species. Species then exist and interact with predators and in a relationship of predator and prey that's a necessary relationship even for the health of the prey species, and all of that results in ecosystems. What happens when species go extinct? Well, an example would be wolf depredation has resulted in overabundance of elk populations in Colorado, which has resulted in poplar tree deforestation. If you introduce wolves, you not only reduce the number of elk, but you keep the elk on the move so they don't camp out in a valley and completely defoliate an entire valley of all the poplar trees. So at many levels, we have to work together for everyone's well-being. In the non-human world, that is, even when you aren't using human intellectual capacity, even animals in the natural world require collective thinking and collaboration, whether they know it or not. And by analogy, humans exist as individuals, but we require families, communities, governments, etc. Individualism is frequently defended as essential in a free society, in contradistinction to societies with collectivist values. In human societies, I would argue collaboration is necessary for flourishing. Now, you might consider the use of individualism as a political philosophy and my biological argument to be sort of a conflation of big ideas, and it might be. But my point is that the collective, the common good, the social contract, that collaboration, a purpose that transcends any individual person or organ or species is essential and currently is being threatened in many levels. Another example on the biological level would be biological cooperation. Survival of the fittest would be an example where it's often been misunderstood to mean competition between individual organisms. That is, it's dog eat dog. But fittedness to each other is also an important part of evolution. The 1930s, Ashley Montague considered excessive focus on competition, individual competition, as the Darwinian fallacy, no less. And Haldane of the, you know, Haldane hypothesis that chemists are familiar with, insofar as it makes for the survival of one's descendants and near relations, altruistic behavior is a kind of Darwinian fitness and may be expected to spread as a result of natural selection. So altruism is necessary in biological systems. How do we explain empathy and altruism from an evolutionary perspective? Does it not require each individual organism to selfishly perpetuate themselves? This thinking is based on the presupposition of individualism. In fact, in evolution, it isn't each organism for itself, rather it's each gene pool for itself. And this requires cooperation. Individualism is an insufficient meta-narrative biologically. It isn't each individual trying to optimize their own fecundity in one lifetime. Rather, it's the population, the species, whose advantage is being accomplished in evolution, not the individual organism. Secondly, sociologically. Individualism also comes up short sociologically, and one example would be social solidarity on a racial basis. Heather McGee, a race and racism scholar, has talked about a functioning society relies on a web of mutuality, and the book that this came from is a book called The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone, and How Everyone Can Prosper Together. So her argument is racism harms the perpetrator as much as it does the victims. A functioning society rests on a web of mutuality, a willingness among all involved to share enough with one another to accomplish what no one person can do alone. She says, the zero-sum idea that white people are now suffering due to gains among people of color has taken on the features of a myth. It lies, but it says so much. And to use Charles Taylor, who's a, you know, many of us evangelicals are a fan of Charles Taylor, we need a new social imaginary regarding what our shared public life together would look like. Think for a moment, what would Christians, if Christians were to approach church with the attitude of what's in it for me, what would that church look like? And have you observed a situation where a majority of people put me in the center, their own prerogatives, judgments, and desires, and what does that look like? With that, I'd like you to just think about it for a minute. What does excessive individualism look like in a family, in a neighborhood, a church, your workplace, a scientific association, the ASA, your country, our world? So that's my sociological argument. And I know I'm going fast, but want to get to some discussion as well. My third argument would be theological. 1 Corinthians 12. I would argue that individualism does not work theologically either. 1 Corinthians 12, just as the body, though one, has many parts, but all its many parts form one body, so it is with Christ. Although Christian faith is deeply personal, it draws the person into a saving, transforming relationship with God through Jesus Christ, but it is never individualistic. Desmond Tutu, the Nobel Prize-winning Anglican Archbishop from South Africa, used the word Ubuntu. I don't know if we have anybody here who speaks Afrikaans, but, meaning that one could only be a person through one's relationship with others, bound intrinsically in community. Ephesians 4:4 says that there's one body and one spirit, and then further on, he gave apostles, prophets, evangelists, shepherds, and teachers for the building up of the body of Christ. So the chief threat to Ubuntu in South Africa is the heresy of individualism and its pernicious effects on our lives and in our churches. So if I had a big idea in this talk, it's that individualism is inadequate in guiding as a guiding principle in our human world. Now, you might be wondering if all this is bad. You know, none of us want to live under, you know, a tyrannical government, or we want to give up the liberating forces of political systems that threw off that tyranny. So the movement for human rights has also been a function, has been a space for individuals that came from views of individualism. But I would argue that biblical wisdom has a different starting point. God's saving work always moves toward creating a faithful community of God's people. The fulcrum of God's justice falls on the side of shaping the shared life of a people whose hospitality and faithfulness reflect the covenantal love of God. Paul's declaration in 1 Corinthians 12 that we are parts of one body and members of one another is a sharp rebuke against the heresy of individualism as one can find. And as a word of hope, I would like to suggest that the church might be one last bastion of this kind of community in our society, which is facing an epidemic of loneliness and lack of social solidarity. Another element to the theological argument is that of sin. Christopher Watkins, fascinating book, last year, Biblical Critical Theory, I recommend it, talks about the heart of sin as autonomy. That is a direct no to God and a direct no to receiving the grace of God. Thomas Schindler, a Catholic theologian, says individualism is a hindrance to social justice. The cornerstone of individualism is freedom. However, this freedom is not the freedom God intends. It is a freedom from, which is to gain power for oneself, one's own desires and goals. But individualism focuses on the one self-centered goal. The self-centered individual finds himself alienated from both society and from God. And as Isaiah Berlin, using that same freedom from, freedom for, in his The Two Types of Freedom book from the 1950s, what we are missing is a freedom for, that is a freedom for a higher vision that transcends the individual, as opposed to a freedom from anything that encroaches upon my own individual autonomy. So I'll summarize these first three arguments using this kind of picture. Suggestion is that the necessity of a collective approach, biologically, we need that for ecological balance. We need that as an act of stewardship of the natural world, the environment that we've been called in Genesis 1:26 to steward and look after, as well as sustainability. In my home state of North Dakota, our grasslands have been reduced by like 30% in the last 15 years, and consequently, our meadowlark populations are just going down. So there has to be a view of sustainability biologically, which requires no one individual can lay claim to their own personal best interests. Sociologically, non-segregation would be an element of that. Inclusivity and a spirit of inclusion, as well as a global perspective that transcends geopolitical boundaries. And then theologically, there is the hope of our sharedness, our shared life together as one body in Christ, expressed in unity and experienced in Christian community, which I know I'm speaking to the choir here, which is we are part of those Christian communities, and we see that and we experience that, and that's wonderful. Now I'd like to turn my talk in the final part here to the sort of the title, which is Healthy Individuals and Sick Populations, as an application of this concern that individualism as a social philosophy mitigates against social flourishing and human flourishing. So what do I mean by healthy individuals living in sick populations? So population health is a new and critical way of imagining health from a collective rather than an exclusively individualistic perspective. The definition would be that the health outcomes of groups of individuals, including the variability of those health outcomes within those groups. So it's an approach to health that aims to improve the health of the whole population, not only each distinct, discrete, one after another individual. In the United States, it's actually difficult to accomplish improved population health. And if any of you have groaned when you see the data that says we're like the global health indicators, we're like this 36th best country in the world in terms of our health system, it's not that we don't have great doctors, pharmacists, medicines, technology, equipment. It's that our system is set up to be excessively individualistic. It's decidedly biased in favor of a health system where individual interests predominate. The result is that while many individuals are healthy, they reside within sick populations. Furthermore, the system as it exists is unable to create healthy populations. So it's my hypothesis that this is a result of excessive individualism and that this is an obstacle to creating healthy populations. And here's a way of thinking about that. This is a healthy individual out at the rib fest. A healthy individual, but in a sick population. Now, what do I mean by sick populations? Many of those individuals are living a decent life. They have no debilitating chronic diseases. They might have some degree of social connectedness and living the life they want. They have stable employment, health insurance, and adequate housing. So many of these individuals are healthy. But with so many healthy individuals, how could there be a sick population? When most of us have our own health to be good and our healthcare provider to be effective, it comes down to many individuals within this population are smokers, they might have little physical activity, they're obese, they're eating poorly, they don't have good health insurance. So although presently they might, as an individual, not be like hospitalized, they are on the precipice of being very unhealthy as an individual, which in the aggregate then says the population is not healthy. That's sort of the view. Now I'd like to think about that from the perspective of alcoholism as an example. This figure shows that this is a study from a large number of countries, sites, 52 centers in 32 countries. This is the prevalence of heavy drinking. So most societies would say, would you like to see a reduction in the prevalence of alcohol abuse in your country? We'd say yes. We'd like to have fewer alcoholics. So we'd like to have, you know, less than 10%. This variable along the x-axis is mean alcohol intake. Question, what determines how much alcohol an individual person drinks? Answer, how much the people around them drink. So the mean level of alcohol intake is in direct, like 0.97, association with the percentage who end up being alcoholic. If we would like to reduce the percentage of persons who are alcoholics in our society, everyone in society needs to drink that much less, which would then increase it would decrease the number of individuals who end up having an alcohol abuse problem. Population health. Climate change is another example. And yes, that is a photo of Jessica Moorman. She presented to our students at NDSU. So climate change is another example. Climate change isn't about the weather over my head, because in fact, I come from North Dakota. I would like to see a longer growing, farmers would like to see a longer growing season and a shorter winter. But climate change has nothing to do with how it's affecting warmer days in winter in North Dakota. It has to do with the global average temperature. And it's the individuals at the extreme of that curve who are suffering from climate change. So climate change isn't about what do I think about it or how does it affect me? It's how does it affect our whole world at the extremes? A final example is individualism and COVID. So this is a figure showing all the countries in the world. This is the COVID deaths per million. Along here is an individualism scale. The higher the individualism, the US being the highest, the higher the number of COVID deaths. The lower the individualism scale, the lower the COVID deaths. Now, why is that? Well, the reason is because a more collectivist orientation would result in attitudes that would value the public good, which would then allow clan behavior, which says, I'm going to have behaviors that are community oriented. And then finally, the decision will be my willingness to sacrifice for the common good. Now, does that mean the individual is gone? No. The individual is meant to be expressed within the society or within the community. So what are the limitations? Limitations to the theory or the idea or to my argument. Since the Enlightenment, Western culture has been constructed around individual rights. Individualism was necessary for the concept of human rights. It empowers people to go against the grain, and many societies are moving to be more individualistic over time. So there's nothing, you know, those are reasonable, like, ways to think about it. However, I'm afraid that individualism, although a component part of our human existence, has to be experienced within community. Biological systems and ecosystems require interdependence. Human society depends on conceding to the greater good for all to flourish. Scripture places more emphasis on the population, the body, the group, than the individual. The church is one body comprised of interdependent persons with many gifts. And I might change this word, suppress individualism. I might say hold accountable. Hold accountable individualism and selfishness to serve the greater good. Thank you.
Hey, Mark. I'm really tracking with what you're saying about individualism. And I was just thinking this morning as we were singing, and the little songs that we were singing, like, Jesus, I love you for what you've done for me. I wonder if our Christian music needs to change.
So maybe we need to change the worship songs to be more community oriented. Yeah. I'll take that as a recommendation. I don't have an answer.
This is great, and I completely agree.
Speaking to the mic, everyone, please. Well,
I'm too short. Okay, this is great. I completely agree. I'm curious. I feel that witnessing America, particularly with the COVID pandemic, that we as people like the idea of individualism, but we're so radically individual that we start clustering in our, as an individual Christian nationalist or as an individual, you know, whatever. So I feel like the Klan culture almost evolves out of individualism. Mm. So my question, I guess, is what community do you see? Because as in America, we're so individualistically minded that do you see, it's not a good question, do you see like all of the United States being one community, or is it more suppressing individualism rather than focusing on the community? Does that make sense? This is the question.
Yeah, if I could understand, should we be suppressing individualism or should we be cultivating collective-oriented thinking more so?
Yeah.
And then at
yeah.
what level would the community exist? So are we one country, you know, one, so our community, probably it's multi-tiered, you know, this thing has layers. So as a country, could we have one shared vision of what it means to be American? And then, you know, as you go down, you could have differing levels. Certainly, there's never just one collective. And that might be the biggest critique of like an extreme communist country, for example. You know, it's absolutism, individualism is exterminated, and it's one national community, so-called. The alternative would be that it's more like multiple levels. So I don't know exactly, I take your recommendation, you know, to heart. I think that's at what level does community happen? And that's why I said, I think the church is our last bastion in this country. You know, let's not give up on the church. Let's not give up on the tendency for the church to divide. Let's redouble down on the church being that community. Thank you.
Hey, Mark, a great talk. That was really, really good. So within a population, you can actually, individualism can drive evolution in the form of sexual selection, and it's typically done through like female hypergamy and male polygamy. Now, in our society, that's always been suppressed by Christianity, which, you know, kind of forbades those a little bit. But as we're approaching more of a secular age, how do you think these forces will kind of, you know, impact our society? And then also, what are the, you know, effects it'll have as that society encroaches back towards on the church itself?
So which forces?
Oh, like say female hypergamy and male polygamy. So usually you have in, you know, cultures where you'd have, you know, in the animal world, you have like one strong male, the women are attracted to him and they would all mate with him and all the other guys would get nothing. And you'd see that in times where you have a king would have a harem and, you know, they would have all the women would be attracted to that. And then, you know, the rest of the people would be, men would be peasants. And that was something that was really different when Christianity took over. So you see it in Islam or say in yeah. Asian cultures. So how do you think, as we see more of that, you see people like Andrew Tate or, you know, these kind of people rising up. How will that impact, you know, you think, you know, society, and then how that will affect our church?
I don't know. There's a lot going on there. You know, polygamy, I mean, obviously, all kinds of factors. From an evolutionary perspective, I'm not sure. You know, I think sociologically, there's a lot of risks involved because I think the competition that results from that can tear apart sociological relationships, but it might be on an individual basis perpetuating your, you know, your own line. I'm not sure, Karma.
Yeah. I'm just wondering like how that will affect, you know, we see that as how that's affecting the church, you know, Christianity, mm-hmm. Is that going to be suppressing it or is that going to really tear us apart?
Yeah. I'm not sure. We'll put that one to the front of the, you know, consideration. Yeah.
Very thoughtful presentation. Appreciate it. You seem to be proposing a new population health paradigm, but we already have a fairly large public health initiative, infrastructure in our country right now. How would you distinguish those two?
Public health is a government agency to accomplish 10 essential public health services. Population health is a national value that says, I'm not thriving unless we're all thriving. And if big segments of our population in my state of North Dakota, American Indian communities have a 10-year lower life expectancy, I cannot thrive living in a state where American Indians are dying 10 years earlier. So the public health answer is then the public health system needs to be delivering programs with a population health vision in mind. That's how I would distinguish it. So public health is a system that delivers certain services using taxes. Population health is a vision that would actually be implemented in our medical systems as well. So if you want to talk more about that, I can talk after, but that's the best I can do to distinguish the two.
So Mark, I want to, you made a statement in response to another question about the tendency of the church to be divisive within the church.
And into the mic,
can you step
please.
Up? These mics, you got to be pretty close.
Okay.
Thank you.
You mentioned in response to a previous question, the tendency for within the church is we become divided. I'm wondering if you are preaching to the choir to a certain extent here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm thinking of groups, and I'm hoping I'm not misrepresenting them, like Cornwall Alliance, Hillsdale College, which my read is they would view the individualistic and economic approach as the biblical approach. Mm-hmm. I'm not certain how I would relate to those people, and I wonder if you have any suggestions.
Well, I think that's part of the national conversation we're having, because I know that what I've proposed today is something that there's large portions of our population would vehemently disagree, because I think their vision is driven more by the flourishing of those with whom they agree. And so I think the interaction is to not villainize or imply that that's, you know, somehow that's a bad person who looks at it that way. And to, you know, really to ask the question, what is it that we want to enjoy together as a society? What kind of a society do you want to live in? And the plight of American Indians in my state is not a society that I want to live in because of the pain it causes all of us to observe. So, you know, I guess that would be one answer that I would give. Now, as far as preaching to the choir, I am concerned that even our churches have also moved toward an individualistic view. So we pop around one church to another just when we disagree. We are all independents because we don't want to be a part of a denomination, and then because somebody in headquarters will tell us what to do. And I think even that is also we're paying a price for that at the local church level, because eventually those individuals will also turn on their own pastor as well, potentially.
Last question.
Thank you. Awesome talk. And in line with the comments you've just made, you're saying to hold individualism accountable, we need to be in community. And it seems like a lot of people nowadays are turning to social media to do that, which is relying on algorithms, which appear to be not really bringing us together, but actually pushing us together to opposite ends. And so my question is, I want to hear your comments on what you think about that and how as individuals in one body, we can bring us all back together.
So how do we hold social media companies accountable? I think the fact that we are largely a Wall Street driven country. And so if Facebook generates GDP, few Americans are interested in getting in the way of that, because you might have stocks in Facebook, even though it might be harming your own children. So I don't know, other than turning the light on. I mean, I just read a book by Jonathan Haidt, The Anxious Generation. I recommend it if you give it consideration, but it's basically talking about the psychological harm to Gen Z as a result of smartphone apps. So I'm not exactly sure, other than we need a new vision. It's a vision of freedom for, and it's the freedom for a flourishing society that thinks more about the greater good than the self. It's not a vision of freedom from, where we just sort of say, okay, what policies, laws, seatbelt laws, smoking laws, speeding laws are impinging upon my personal preference. And it's casting a vision for a flourishing society where we all do better, we all do well. I really appreciate everyone's participating in this talk. I welcome your interaction, your thoughts. My desire is to see the ASA continue to hold strongly to our sense as a community, as an association, as a big tent. We disagree vehemently, and then we hug each other and go have dinner together. Could we model that for a society and a world? And so I know I'm preaching to the choir, but I hope I've given a few thoughts that can put it into theoretical perspective in a helpful way. So thank you.
Thank you very much.